not to kill. And I don't care what religion you're in, except perhaps Satanism, you know, whether it's you're a pagan or a Buddhist or a Hindu or Judeo-Christian, you know, that instruction is out there, thou shalt not kill. But how does God know if we'll kill or not unless we're tested?
Well, it sort of seems to be the nature of the planet. I guess some people say this is just a big school and we're here to learn. If we had a perfect planet, how would we learn our lessons?
Right. And how would God really know what we will do when we're pushed and shoved and tested, except by pushing and shoving and testing us? And it may be that when we all transcend to the next place that Bush is one of the greatest avatars, and, you know, I kind of doubt it. I think he's kind of innocent.
I have my doubts about
his bigger purpose. But, you know, he is, you know, he said he was the great uniter, and he's certainly uniting a lot of people in the belief that we have to do more. We can't just talk peace. We actually have to do more if we want to create peace on the planet. And we can't just sit back and luxuriate and eat good food and enjoy the wonderful sunshine in this particular part of the world, that we really need to be proactive in creating the kind of peace that is talked about in our various spiritual teachings.
Very much so. Well said. Well said.
Yeah, and that's the only thing that's helping me get through this time is remembering that this is not our end goal, you know, being on this planet and having a good time is not our end goal. It's certainly, we should enjoy what we do have, and we should be inspired to, you know, share that with others, but not at the cost of killing them.
So most folks out there, you know, I've talked about this whole business about our tax dollars going to support war and going to subsidize the whole military-industrial complex. And I don't know, for most folks, what it's going to take for them to draw the line and say no more. I will no longer participate in this insanity, this mass murdering of people. I don't know. I suppose everyone has their line in the sand beyond which they won't cross. Maybe for some people it has to be until their front door is busted down and their family hauled off will they finally stop doing. But other people are drawing lines much sooner.
And that's the spiritual testing that's going on. You know, not everybody gets to graduate. You know, there are many... I think it's a quote from Jesus, in my house there are many mansions, and I prefer to think, you know, my translation of that, in my house is there are many de-mansions or dimensions. And for those who are really content to play this game of killing and superiority and that, you know, I know best, I know better than you, I don't even have to know who you are, because so many of the people who are pro-war in Iraq haven't a clue who the Iraqi people are. But people who are willing to play that game, you know, get to move on into dimensions that allow them to keep playing that game. And I'm done with that. I'm done, you know. So I'm going to a dimension in the house that really is, you know, where those souls congregate that are into being cooperative and loving and helping one another evolve in consciousness, because we've all got a ways to go. I figure any of us who are on the earth at this time aren't here because we were the most advanced beings in the universe. So spiritually speaking, we've all got something to learn. But, you know, I know by my choices I will, so folks, where do you want to wind up, you know, when you finally have to leave this planet, which we all do? Do you want to go hang out with more people who are pushing and shoving and trying to make, you know, trying to conquer the world? Or are you ready to hang out with people who are loving and cooperative and really want to enjoy relationships and creating together?
Well, what you're talking about, it really comes down to choices. And I think since you mentioned the Bible there,
And it's not just the Bible. I mean, these are
universal
religious teachings,
right.
and they're very simple.
But it's one of the things that I remember is, you know, each day is before you, and you have the capacity each day to choose good or choose evil. What do you choose? Mm-hmm. And I think we can do this every time we buy something or don't buy something. It makes a difference where we spend our time, how we choose to spend our time. So.
And I don't even want to use the word evil, because I, you know, it's obviously part of the spiritual growth process to delve into those realms where you are playing with superiority and playing with, I can make my will be done over you because I have a gun and I have the biggest weapon, and you know that may just be part of the spiritual growth process. As we now understand how kids grow up, they go through certain stages where they have to exert their will, or they're way dependent on mama or whatever, that are normal growth processes. But I just want to encourage those who are done with it. It's okay to be done with it. We, you know, we've got many, many eons of evolution ahead of us, and by our choices, we get to really determine how we get to evolve. And you know, whatever George Bush, what power he may have, is only in this realm, only in this realm.
Well, it's well said. Do you what do you see in terms of activism, though, and actually, oops, I see we're getting towards the end of our show. Theodore, it's been really great talking with you.
Well, thank you, and thank you for being here every Monday.
Well, thank you very much. Good night.
Okay, bye-bye.
And good night to everyone else.
Well, good evening. This is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that will determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you that the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of this station. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers. We welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But please hold your calls for a few minutes. We have with us Steve Doran. And Steve, of course, was working at Los Alamos Center, the nuclear laboratory there. I guess it's in New Mexico, as in charge of security or working in security there. And he has an amazing story to tell. Now, Steve, thank you so much for being with us again.
Thank you for having me again.
Well, let's go ahead and why don't you tell our listeners just a little bit about yourself and how you happened to end up at Los Alamos.
I've been involved in law enforcement for about 18 years. I've also been a search, rescue, and survival instructor. I was in the, uh, I, was in an intelligence unit in the Marine Corps. Are we having a sound problem?
No, we're doing fine.
Okay. After working in the Metro Detroit area as an assistant division chief, then moving on to Idaho as a chief of police, after 9/11, I was recruited by Los Alamos to work in their Office of Security Inquiries to work on matters of national security and theft problems and that type of thing going on in the laboratory.
All right, fine. So you now, when did you go to Los Alamos first?
I was recruited in January it was January 2002. I actually didn't start till July of 2002.
So you thought you were to go down there and sort of straighten things out, and if there was any stealing and things of that sort, why, you were supposed to find the culprits. You didn't understand that you weren't really supposed to do your job. So why don't you pick up the story from there?
Okay, as you just stated, I was recruited to, clean up the theft of the laboratory, so I thought. They almost begged me to take the position. When I arrived, from my second day on the job, I began working with the FBI and other federal law enforcement agencies in an effort to, solve those problems. And instead of being, praised for the work that I was doing and the issues that I was uncovering, I was told, to be careful, to remember who I worked for, that it was, my responsibility to make sure that the image of the lab didn't suffer. I really didn't understand, what I was dealing with and the concept and that type of thing. As time went on, they made it more and more difficult for me to do my job. I was finally ordered not to deal with any outside law enforcement agencies. A few weeks after that, I was terminated.
Well, now, of course, was the FBI aware of what was going on there?
Yes, they were, and in fact, they were most certainly one of my biggest supporters. They repeatedly asked the laboratory to allow me to continue working the cases that I was working and allow me to continue to work alongside them. On every time that they made that request, the request was denied.
Now, who was making this decision? Was this the head of the laboratory? Was this the assistant head of the laboratory? Who was doing the cover-up?
It was the, as far as I know, for a fact, it was the assistant deputy director, a guy by the name of Joseph Salgado, the director of security, Stanley Busboom, and the assistant director, which is a guy by the name of Gene Tucker.
So they all know what was going on, and they just wanted you there so it was an affront for them, but they had no real intention of trying to solve the problem. Now, how large or significant was this problem? Are we talking about, a few thousand dollars, a few hundred thousand dollars of government equipment that is being stolen?
In my opinion, over the years, and again, this would be pre-me, hundreds of millions of dollars in equipment, either stolen and or just wasted, just left out to rot.
All right, so hundreds of millions of dollars, but then after all, it's government money. Who really cares, except maybe us taxpayers?
Right.
And,
well,
of course, is there any accountability? Is anybody held? I mean, is there any means of keeping an inventory? And, when I was in the military as a unit commander, I had to sign for all the equipment in my division, and I was responsible for that being there when I left.
That's correct, and in the real world, that's how it works. In Los Alamos, they don't account for anything under $5,000, and the accountability is very sketchy on items over $5,000, and then there are items that are purchased that are literally just wasted, that literally are just left out in the open to rot and disintegrate over time, or parts and things that are ordered, that are left outside, that are never used as parts of experiments, and then just thrown away.
Well, now, of course, when we talked earlier, you commented that there were water tanks, and these massive water tanks would just disappear, and cryogenic things that you'd use.
Cryogenic freezers.
Right, and so you can't just, these things just don't disappear.
Right. Well, that was one of my comments. When the report came down that this 3,000-gallon water tank was missing, I flippantly said, you know, they told me it was lost, and I said, well, who put it in their back pocket and took it home, you know, from work? I said, this is just BS, and somebody needs to be accountable, and you need to tell me when this thing was last used, if it was ever used, and where it was installed. And, you know, it was that type of situation that we ran into constantly, where we would have people call up and say, well, you know, I went home last night, and today my computer's missing. And I'm like, you know, a desktop computer doesn't just get up and walk away. And a lot of these items, you know, they had forklifts, you know, that type of thing. There was a tremendous amount of abuse in the credit card area of the laboratory. They were purchasing Santa Claus suits, elf suits.
Now, basically, they give these government employees their own credit card to spend on, supposedly for government things, but they can buy anything they want to.
Well,
and does anybody check to find out if they're getting things for their personal use?
Well, nobody was checking but us. I mean, we caught a woman getting cash advances at a casino, renting hotel rooms that weren't authorized. One lady tried to order a Mustang, a high-performance classic Mustang, to the tune of $30,000. We were able to intercede on that one.
No, but what was done to her in the way of punishment?
As far as I know, we were terminated before her case came before the committee. But as far as I know, at this point, she's been terminated.
She was terminated for that,
yeah.
Then.
I better not go into that because I may corrupt the FBI's investigation. But there is currently an investigation pending.
All right, fine. So, how long were you there before they fired you?
I started in July. I was fired 2 days prior to Thanksgiving. Again, it was one of those situations where the only thing that we did, Glenn Walp and myself did, was we did our job, and we did it very well. And when we refused to, go along with the mainstream and cover things up, and you know, they said, well, remember who you work for, and we said, we do remember who we work for. We work for the United States taxpayer. It's their money that we're protecting, and as far as we're concerned, University of California and the Los Alamos National Laboratory is just a vehicle to get our paycheck, but our responsibility goes to a much higher authority, and we are not going to get discontinued doing what we're doing.
Now, of course, the University of California here actually has a contract, and they've operated the Los Alamos Laboratory for how many years?
60.
For 60 years. And obviously, there was no control over this at all until you begin to rock the boat. In other words, you, of course, begin talking about this. Didn't you get a fair amount of press coverage and things of that sort?
Oh, yeah. I've been on every national news program at least once, most of them two and three times. I've been on national radio programs across the country. I usually do two or three radio interviews a week. Along with television interviews and just a mass, I've been in every major newspaper literally hundreds of times since this whole thing began.
All right, so this is very embarrassing for the University of California. My goodness, you know, they may lose their contract. How much do they get from the federal government for mismanaging this laboratory? Do you have any idea?
Well, actually, the University of California, the way the contract's set up is, they don't make any money and they don't lose any money. Where they actually quote unquote make money is one of the reasons we feel that we were hired is there's a thing called Appendix O, and that's where the university gets a several million dollar bonus each year to use to conduct whatever experiments or whatever programs they want to they want to conduct. And what we feel happened is that we were specifically hired for our resumes. We were brought in as heavy hitters so they could go back to the government and say, hey, look, we hired these guys. They were considered to be the best in the country, and they couldn't find anything and see, you know, what we've been telling you all along is that there's no problems here. These guys couldn't find it, and, so everything's fine. Well, the plan backfired because when they told us to back off, we didn't. We continued to move forward with our investigation, and and it didn't work out the way they planned.
All right, fine. So now you got fired, you get a lot of publicity, and suddenly there's a tremendous concern. Oh, my goodness, maybe there is some control. You know, you've got congressional investigations, you've got congressmen hot after this, and they're talking about pulling away the contracts from the University of California. So then what happens?
Well, after everything was exposed, the individual who was running the program at the university level was removed from his position, meaning the guy who was overseeing the contract from the university was removed. I don't know if he was terminated or not. A new gentleman stepped up to the plate, a guy by the name of Bob Darling and another gentleman named Joe Mullinex. They went in, they removed, I think, 17 people from their position. They terminated the deputy director. And it's still up in the air whether additional terminations will take place. And as I said earlier in your earlier program, there is a hearing tomorrow, there's a hearing Wednesday before the Energy and Commerce Committee. And prior to that hearing, you know, I would plead with your audience to go to www.congress.gov, click on committees, go to the Energy and Commerce Committee, and let them know that you're upset with the situation, that you don't like seeing taxpayers' dollars wasted, that you don't like seeing a national laboratory that, you know, could have information leaks like a sieve, and that you are demanding that they, you know, pressure the University of California into terminating these people that were involved in these cover-ups and who were involved in wasting taxpayer dollars.
Now, for our listeners out there, of course, Steve was rehired. He was told, we want you really to clean this thing up. And at least so far, he's been given pretty much of an open door to do what really needed to be done to investigate and, you know, to try to get to the bottom of this. But remember that the contract for the University of California is still pending. So, you know, they've got to try to appear to be very good. Let's just hope that they're really very, very sincere. You would think, though, that after 60 years, they would have done something before this tremendous publicity and really showing the total corruption there. Now, basically, as far as the average individual there, are there people there trying to do a good job? Are there people there who are just there because they get a fabulous salary? I mean, these people get higher salaries than almost any place else in the country. What were you saying, that your chief was making $180,000 and essentially doing nothing?
That's correct. I mean, basically, you have people there who are making these phenomenal salaries to literally do nothing. I mean, they try to make themselves look good. They change statistics. They order people, you know, not to write reports. I was ordered on two separate occasions to change my reports. And basically, you know, to them, I mean, that's their money tree. They would never make this. First of all, they would never probably even get a job outside the system. And if they did get a job outside the system, they definitely would not make the money that they make at the laboratory. Now, I want to make it very clear that, you know, not everyone at that laboratory is corrupt. I mean, there are a lot of wonderful people who work there, people who love their country, who are there specifically, you know, for the betterment of their country, and we wouldn't have gotten as far in our investigations as we did if it hadn't been for those people feeding us information and allowing us, you know, to, you know, get into the inner sanctum, if you will, and really dig out the information. So, you know, a lot of this problem just revolves around the upper management, the finance people, the security people, that type of thing. The average worker, for the most part, are just really good, hardworking people.
All right, but it seems to be the people in positions of power, as so often, they seem to gravitate there, and one corrupt person seems to get other corrupt
right.
people there so they can cover for one another.
Right, and that's the way that we saw it. I mean, again, I have no evidence at this juncture, you know, to prove it, but I have called for, you know, the removal of the finance people and the people in authority and property, and also security. And my reason for that is I truly believe that they've all been involved in, you know, some type of illegal shenanigan at one time or another, or some type of impropriety. And what they do is, you know, you scratch my back, I'll scratch yours, and it's just been going on for years and years.
Well, unfortunately, this is so common within the function of government. And government is by its very essence, this is the way that it is, whether it's the state government, the local government, until people are held responsible, certainly no corporation could run this way at all.
Right.
It would go bankrupt.
Oh, any organization, I mean, if a state were to run, its operations like this, I mean, the state would be bankrupt. Any corporation who were to run their operations, like Los Alamos runs their operations, would literally be out of business in a matter of days, in my opinion. But again, you're dealing with an organization whose budget is, I believe, $2 billion a year. I mean, it's like a bottomless pit as far as money is concerned, and their only concern is getting it spent so that they get more. And the reality is that this isn't, they do produce excellent science at this laboratory, but the thieving and the manipulation of funds and that type of thing basically are going on at the support staff level, not at the scientific level. So if you really broke it down and you looked at security and you looked at science, that would be money well spent. It's the money in between that's being just totally wasted.
All right. Well, now, of course, you said that really this is supposedly top American science. We're spending all this money because, of course, we have the wicked communists and wicked enemies throughout the world, and we're trying to maintain the strength of our defense unit. And yet, you say this thing is run like a sorority house, where everybody's in and out all the time, and they're really we bring people from all over the country in just to take nice tours and get information. What's that all about?
Right. Well, as far as the tours, again, as I told you earlier today, I don't have any firsthand knowledge of this, but I did hear that an IG report came out stating that persons were allowed, not only in Los Alamos Laboratory but our other premier laboratories across the country who were not cleared, who were scientists from foreign, enemy nations, who were not escorted properly, who did not, pass the proper criteria to enter the laboratory. And I would believe that that report would be available online with the Department of Energy.
No, I was reading just the other day that Iraqi scientists, nuclear scientists, were allowed to come and look at our facilities in about 1995. And it's just, we know that the Chinese communists can get into just about anything we have. We're going to be having to take a little brief interlude here, and we'll be back in just a moment or two with our special guest. And his name is Steve Doran. If you have a question or comment, don't be bashful. Give us a call at 1-888-24-LIBERTY or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. Of course, we're talking about what's going on at Los Alamos National Laboratory. $2 billion a year, and of course, no controls at all over how your tax money is being spent. And if you don't spend it all, you don't get more next year. Well, this is Dr. Stan and Steve Doran, of course, now has been put back on the job. And how long have you been back on the job now?
I was actually reinstated in January. I've actually only really been back on the job a few weeks.
All right, fine. Now, when does this contract come up for reevaluation? In other words, and how long is this contract, for 6 months or a year, for 5 years? Because obviously, the University of California doesn't want to lose this contract, so they'll do whatever they can to, certainly convince everybody, oh, shucks, we had no idea what was going on. How long, of course, is the contract for? Do you have any idea?
The contract, I believe, typically runs about 5 years. And as I stated earlier in your program, the two gentlemen that have taken over, trying to clean up this mess, Bob Darling and Mr. Mullenix, I mean, I truly believe, and again, I guess you'll just have to take my word for it, but I mean, I truly believe that they're honorable men, and they've done a lot, to correct these problems. And I know for a fact, neither of these two individuals had any idea that the problems were this rampant. And they have addressed all of the issues and continue to, continue to address them. Whether that helps with the, university, getting the contract again, who knows? But my stand has been, whether, I'm a university employee or not, I don't care who fixes the problem. I don't care if it's the University of Michigan, the University of Texas, or, you know, Boeing, whoever takes over the contract. But the reality is we need to start today. Whoever's involved today, whoever's involved in the future has to, you know, continue to persevere to make sure that the American taxpayer dollar is not wasted and that the secrets of that at this national laboratory do not leave this laboratory.
Well, now, are you at all involved with the security of the laboratory? Are you primarily involved with the stealing and the thievery?
Right. Well, as far as the security of the lab, that will be one of my new functions. I have not gotten into that yet, and in my previous position, I was basically involved in, matters of what they call security incidents, which could be matters of national security and criminal activity. I wasn't actually involved in the physical security aspect.
Well, no, I think it was really, I'd heard that literally hundreds of these laptop computers had disappeared. And, you know, you're talking about 2,000, 2,500 good laptop computer with everything on it, $3,000.
Oh, yeah.
How many disappeared?
Well, there were 250 laptops, I believe. Again, I'm just from memory. And then there were an additional several hundred in total desktop-type computers.
And now, it's pretty hard to move a desktop computer. You don't stuff those in your pocket.
That's correct.
So there has to be people helping people to get these things out of there.
Well, it's a pretty open environment, and as I said, it's not like going on to a military base. Los Alamos is basically a campus environment. Most of the areas are unsecure, and if you waited till the right time of day, you can take anything you want to out of that laboratory. And as I explained to you earlier, there is no accountability except on what they call sensitive items. For items under $5,000. So if you buy a generator today for $4,999.99 and it comes up missing tomorrow, nobody's the wiser.
Now, Roy, we're going to be back here in just a moment with Steve. And, this is just such a disheartening story. Hopefully this is going to be a happy ending. So we'll know in just a moment here. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and here our guest this evening is Steve Doran. We're talking about the Los Alamos lab, and of course, you know, a lot of people, when they have a job, and they're given an order, a direct order, don't investigate this. Why, you know, if they've got a pension, they've been there for a long period of time, it's pretty hard to risk everything to do what you should do. One of the big tragedies of modern times is ordinarily if you are working for government and you try to do what's right and you're a whistleblower and you let this out, they will come after you. In fact, it's my understanding that after you were fired, they did everything they could to discredit you and to make you appear to be just terrible individual, terribly incompetent. They actually did everything they could to keep you from ever getting a job in law enforcement again.
Pretty much. I mean, basically, they basically stated that we were hostile, we were combative, that we mistreated people, that we didn't know what we were talking about. We hadn't been there long enough to know what the systems and the way that things worked at the laboratory.
Now, who was saying this?
They would basically have their press people do press releases.
Well, then those people should be fired for putting out false press releases. You have an obligation to do what's right when you're in the press department or public relations, don't you?
Right. Well, again, they were taking their orders from, they were basically answering the questions of the media based on information they were getting from, the other people at the top. So, press people, they're going to put out whatever they're given. And because they weren't intimately involved in the situation, there was no way for them to know.
Well, of course, but don't they have any moral responsibility to make sure that what they're saying is true? Or is it all right if somebody tells you a lie just to repeat it? Don't you have an obligation to try to find out where the truth is if you're working within the press?
Well, again, I mean, if I'm terminated and they hand these press people a file that says, Doran and Walp were terminated for the following reasons, a press individual typically isn't going to say, well, let me see, this statement and that statement. I mean, it just typically doesn't happen. And And, you know, that's not just Los Alamos. That's anywhere that, that press people are employed.
Yeah, so these really sort of, like a hooker, they do whatever they're told to do.
Pretty much.
All right. Well, I think that's a sad commentary, but I'm sure that's what happens in every branch of government. It happens, I'm sure, in industry as well. But, of course, the trouble is that we have a lot of people who are compromised. Now, there must have been other people doing your job beforehand who were compromising on this.
Well, yeah, it was pretty clear they were, that they weren't doing their jobs effectively, and that was one of the reasons we were hired, you know, to come in. And again, I mean, we were, again, I don't think we were hired to be effective. I think we were hired for a resume, and they wanted us to kind of just go with the flow and do what we were told to do.
Well, why isn't the FBI doing anything? They obviously knew it was
going on. They are doing something, and they have been.
Were they doing it before, you know, all this ruckus was raised?
Well, they weren't, because they have to know, in order for the FBI to come in and investigate an incident, they have to know that an incident occurred. And they do, you know, they don't have the ability to just come in and start, you know, pushing people around and say, well, tell me what happened today. There has to be a report, and therefore that's why the Office of Security Inquiries was established, was to report these issues to the FBI, to the Inspector General's office, and the other outside law enforcement agencies. So if they don't get a report, they don't come in and investigate. So but once they received the reports, and once they knew that these things were happening and going on, you know, they immediately came in and they immediately began investigating, and they've done an excellent job, and they continue to do an excellent job.
All right, fine. Well, that is encouraging to know that this is happening, and I think there are an awful lot of good people working within the Federal Bureau of Investigation. You know, it's simply, once again, it seems to be more at the top where there's real problems and cover-ups, and but certainly I think an awful lot of people out in the field are totally dedicated to doing a good job. So, now, you, of course, have been given pretty much of a carte blanche to get to the bottom of things. What about, you know, getting people at the gates checking cars and things like that, so that people just can't be taking out anything they want to? Even at the libraries now, you know, they've got various means of trying to check people, because so many people just steal library books. And,
right.
And now, of course, they put something in the library books, so you go out with it, why there's a beeper that goes off. Is there anything that you can do like that at Los Alamos to make sure they're not taking these things out? Or is there anybody checking at the gates?
Are we getting ready for a break here?
Yeah, we are. All right, fine. We'll be back in just a couple of moments here. And if you're out there across America listening to us, remember our telephone number, 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. And, of course, this is why our founding fathers wanted to limit the power of government, because they knew that government, well, I think it was Thomas Paine who said all societies are good, but even at its best, government is a necessary evil. And this is the problem we have. It's certainly not responsive to the people that are paying the taxes. So we'll be back here in just a moment here at Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here, and our guest this evening is Steve Doran. And, of course, he is, what's your official title now, Steve?
Director of Law Enforcement and System Security.
That sounds very impressive.
Well, basically, my new position requires me to be involved with all of the police officers on all the campuses and all the national laboratories and all the security personnel at those locations as well.
So you're not just there at Los Alamos, you're overseeing all of the campuses then?
Anything that the University of California is involved in, that would be under my jurisdiction.
All right, fine. Well, now, who's looking after the store there at Los Alamos? Because that sounds like it's really one of the major culprits. Do you have good people there now who really begin to look into that?
Actually, I really don't want to get sued
for
slander, so no comment.
All right, fine.
But again, I've only been in the job a short time. I mean, this is something that just transpired, and we are working to, you know, to correct those problems. But like I said, being as new as I am and as fresh as I am in the position, I haven't had a chance to make any major inroads at this point.
Now, Steve told me, and we did a earlier interview, that at Los Alamos, the man in charge of the laboratory was just transferred. He was a scientist. He was transferred back full-time to the laboratory. The assistant director was fired, but there had been several other people were transferred. But as far as you know, there don't been only one person at the top echelon fired after all this covered up?
That's correct. As far as I'm concerned, like I said, I feel that the finance people are responsible, that the director and the assistant director of security are responsible for these problems. And again, I would encourage your listeners to call their congressional representatives and as well as contact the committee, either through their website, by phone, by fax, and let them know how dissatisfied they are with the situation at Los Alamos and that these people need to be terminated at once.
Well, I think that you've at least got a couple of congressmen on your side. Now, the one advantage of our system is that the money has to be appropriated by Congress. And if Congress refuses to appropriate money, why these poor bureaucrats are not going to be able to keep living the way they are. Could you imagine if somebody just gave you a credit card, if you're out there in the audience, and, you know, you can just buy whatever you want to with this, and probably even if you get caught, then nothing much is going to be done. Well, maybe if you're buying a $30,000 car, something would be done, but they really don't even hold you accountable up to $5,000?
Right. Anything purchased under $5,000 is not an accountable item unless it's considered sensitive. And there's a few areas that are considered sensitive, like cameras and tape recorders and things like that. But typically, if it's in your budget, you can buy it. In fact, the Bussolini-Alexander case, the two gentlemen who they sold in excess of $400,000 worth of merchandise, it was a case I was working on with the FBI, they'll be indicted here relatively soon, and hopefully they'll put them under the prison. But every item that they purchased just about was under $5,000, therefore unaccountable, so they went for years and years without being caught. It wasn't until a conscientious employee that worked with them reported the incident that they were even caught. Otherwise, it would have went on for, 10, 20 years. I mean, who knows? They probably never would have been caught.
And, of course, why in heaven's name are they giving people credit cards? I mean, this is just... This is totally illogical. Well, of course, it's so hard to get things through regular channels, and this is so much more efficient. But, you would think that they would know that human nature, especially if there's no accountability, would cause people to certainly take advantage of the system, especially when no one is punished, or at least they haven't been in the past. And this is happening, apparently, in every division of government, where you just get a credit card and go ahead, and use it whenever you want to. And, it's almost like you'd be foolhardy not to take advantage of the system. It looks like the system is set up to be taken advantage of.
Well, that's pretty much true. I mean, you've got a situation where there's no accountability, there's no checks and balances. I mean, there are certain people, they're called buyers, that are issued these credit cards. And my, my opinion is that if a buyer's issued a credit card, and that individual, that particular individual doesn't purchase what he or she is required to purchase based on the rules and regulations with that card, they should be immediately terminated.
But, of course, it's almost impossible to terminate government employees. They have the unions there, and they have the hearings in the civil service, and, all of these protections. At one time, of course, we had the civil service laws put in because, of course, government employees were under, they got rather limited incomes. All they really had was security. Now, of course, they get fabulous incomes. They get fabulous pensions. They get fabulous health care benefits, things that you and I couldn't get. And, of course, now they get a free credit card. And, does everybody get a credit card or just certain people?
No, just certain people get credit cards, and you're right about the salaries at the laboratories. I mean, I wish I made as much as people at the laboratory, but when I went in, I was an entry level, so I didn't make that much while I was there. And now that I'm not there, even though I hold a pretty high level position, I don't make even close to what my counterpart would make at the laboratory. So it's really sort of a lopsided system.
Well, of course, you know, we hear reading these people are saying, well, my goodness, you know, we're going to lose all these good people at the Los Alamos Laboratory, and our country is just going to fall behind in science, and, you know, the morale is terrible because of all this criticism, and you know, we're just not going to have anybody good left, you know, because of all this ruckus that's been raised about corruption. And yet, it's about time something was done to raise a ruckus about corruption. And I think that there's still somebody is trying to cover this whole thing up, making it out as if the media is somehow responsible for the problem.
Well, let me just say this. You know, I would love to see all of these people at the laboratory who are saying that they're going to leave and they're going to quit, get a job somewhere else, making the money that they're making, with the benefits that they have, with the retirement that they have, because even if a new contractor comes in, their pay will stay the same, their benefits will stay the same. Nothing will change. So I would love to see these guys who are whining and taking this stance with the press. You know, this is what I say, go ahead and leave. Get a job somewhere else. You know, it's like, but they won't do it because they can't fare as well anywhere else. Any corporation that they would hire on to would probably fire them in less than a week just based on their incessant whining. And they definitely would not make the money in the private sector that they make here. And the universities don't want them because, you know, they're just a big pain to deal with. You know, the dedicated people who work there, the scientists who, really care about what they're doing in their country, they're not going to leave. It's just, like I said, it's just going to be the whiners and the people who don't belong there anyway. It's, as far as I'm concerned, you know, sayonara, have a nice day and leave.
Well, I think that right now, especially with the economy that it is, why they're not going to leave. In fact, I was watching television this evening, and certainly the community I live in, why, one of the schools is laying almost half of its teachers. There's just no money. And, of course, these people, really, I think the only thing that, they're not about to leave, but I think they ought to start cutting back their salaries like they're cutting back everybody else's salaries. Our country is having real problems. We're running massive deficits. And then until these people are held accountable, doesn't anybody grade these people? It seems like so many of the people we've talked about before, they were just transferred elsewhere. They were not held accountable, and I'm just hoping that you're going to be able to do something about that.
Well, I am too, and like I said, you know, I would just hope that your listeners would make it a point. There is that, again, there's that congressional hearing on Wednesday. It specifically involves the situation here in Los Alamos, and I would encourage them to contact, you know, their congressional representatives, to contact the members of the committee. You can do it through the website at www.congress.gov. And just click on committees, go to Energy and Commerce, and, let your feelings be known that you do not like your tax dollars being wasted.
All right. Well, I would hope that everybody would consider seriously doing that. Now, who is the congressman or congresswoman who is really on top of this?
Congressman Greenwood, and I refer to him as the coolest congressman in Washington. He's a take-no-prisoners kind of guy, and has really... he's actually with the subcommittee, the investigative subcommittee. He's the one who took down Enron, and he's basically been doing the same thing with Los Alamos. He's a wonderful man. He's an honorable man, and I'm pleased to say that I've been able to have dinner with him and spend some time with him. He literally has taken the bull by the horns. He doesn't, when the hearings are taking place, he doesn't go for any bureaucratic BS. And he just wants the truth, and he's making the changes he needs to make, to make Los Alamos accountable for what they do.
Well, now, what about the people? Are the people from Los Alamos being called before the congressional committee?
Yes, we appeared on February 26th to tell our side of the story. The people from Los Alamos are all going to, well, not all of them, but some of them will be appearing this Wednesday. That's why I'm encouraging people to contact their congressional representatives now, and then another hearing will take place after this one with even more people from Los Alamos.
Well, you know, one of the things that really bothers me about these congressional hearings is they put people under oath and they get up there and lie, and they know that they're lying, and they do absolutely nothing about it. And as we saw with the tobacco executives who lied, that there was no evidence, they didn't know that tobacco was addicting, and they had all sorts of studies on it, and other than a slap on the wrist, nothing was ever done to these people who lie. And it seems that we've almost given people a carte blanche to lie under oath, and they get off scot-free. Until people are held responsible, and Congress will hold them responsible, and they just won't do it.
Well, I agree with you 100%, and again, I mean, that's our job as citizens of the United States to let our congressional representatives know that we're not going to tolerate that, and that, you know, we have a power of a vote, and we're going to, do everything in our power to put people in place who are going to enforce those laws. We're not going to let people get on the stand and make a mockery of our country by, blatantly lying, and that those people need to pay, for the crimes that they've committed.
Well, I agree with you totally, and I think it's really so vitally important that you and, because you, your friend Glenn, now Glenn, he was with you there in law enforcement, and is he going to stay on? Is he going to just take off and try to find some sanity someplace else in the world?
Well, I think Glenn is just going to go. He really wants to go back to pure law enforcement. He was the former director of the Pennsylvania State Police, former police commissioner there, and I think he's just had enough, and he wants to go back to be a chief of police of some small town and out west, and just be done with all the bureaucratic, problems that he's run into. He's a really wonderful man, and I hope he gets, whatever it is that he wants.
Well, now, you were a chief of police, too, weren't you, in Idaho?
In Idaho.
And did you leave that position to come to work here?
Yes, I did. I was recruited from that position. As I said, they basically begged me to take this job based on my background working in, counterintelligence, working in, white collar crime type situations. And I had a pretty good reputation across the country. And then this job is obviously out in New Mexico. So for me, being I've been a survival instructor for about 18 years. So I found it pretty gratifying to be out here in the wide open spaces and be able to, practice my craft on the side. So, to me, it was a perfect situation. I would be able to serve my country as well as, do the things that I enjoy. And I was, part of the situation was that I was still able to get involved in teaching people, preparedness and that type of thing. So, I thought I was coming into the perfect situation.
Little did you realize that you weren't really there to do a job. You were there just to sort of for window dressing. And because the trouble is that so many people will compromise their position, and I think that they probably figured that you wouldn't want to give up your salary and the so-called security there. And I'm glad you did. Well, let's go to Theodore, calling from Santa Cruz. Hi, Theodore. How are you doing?
Hi. Excellent program, and I've been following the case that you're involved in, Steve, and I really congratulate you on holding true to the higher values. And I'm encouraged because there's a lot of discussion in this community and obviously in the Bay Area and actually all of California right now about law enforcement having problems adhering to those higher values, because that temptation to hold on to your job at any cost permeates this society, not just the Los Alamos labs. So my question to you is, do you have any opinion or just from your observations about what's going on in San Francisco with the challenge to the law enforcement community there to adhere to higher standards what's happening because of that?
The problem is just like anywhere else in society. I mean, I feel that I'm responsible to a higher power, and that I have an obligation to, behave in a certain way and act in a certain way because, I have two young boys that I feel, that I have to, bring up in the way that they should go. I also believe in the Lord Jesus Christ, and I believe that He actually directs my steps, and that I have a responsibility to Him. And if you don't have those basic values, and I don't want to get into you know, a big controversy here, but if you don't have those values, then it's never going to work.
Well, you're on Dr. Stan's show, so there's no controversy on those values.
Okay, fine. Well, anything else, Theodore?
Well, just, so in terms of where you're at as a law enforcement, you're happy to see, consequences for bad action and whatever.
Right. I believe that people should be held accountable for their actions, regardless of how minor or how major. And if we forget that or we don't, we don't enforce that in the workplace, regardless of where that workplace is. Mm-hmm. I mean, basically, you just see this deterioration over time that is almost irreparable.
And really, we're seeing it really sweeping through the country. I'm doing an interview tomorrow with a fellow named Corbett, and he was actually a police chief in a suburb of Chicago. He was recruited by Sam Giancana to go into the police force to cover for the mob. And, of course, it's a fascinating story. I'm looking at it. I'll be doing that in the afternoon. And, of course, eventually, of course, he got sent to prison, had a contract on his life by the mob. And, of course, he's written a book, and it may very well cost him his life, but it should be interesting. But, you know, the thing is that they've infiltrated and got bad people there, but there's good people, too. And the thing is, we've got to stand behind the good people and support them at every step, because it's a tough position to be in. You're in the spotlight, and everybody's out after the police officers. Occasionally, there are things that are done, and I think in San Francisco, knowing San Francisco, I'm not at all surprised that they would just, certainly cover up malfeasance. And I don't think a police officer, in fact, I think a police officer, like a minister, like a doctor, is held to a higher standard of morality than the average citizen. And I believe that. And if we don't hold them to that higher standard, we've got nobody to blame but ourselves.
Right. Well, I want to thank you both for shining a bright light in the dark corners of American society. Thank you both.
Bye-bye, Theodore. Thank you.
Well, also, Dr. Stan, one of the things that people have to realize is in most states, I'm not sure about the state of California, there are laws on the books which basically, if a public official like a policeman or a mayor or elected official violates the public trust, the consequences for doing that are typically 10 times worse than the actual law, protecting the citizens in that same situation. As an example, if a public official steals money, the term is usually 10 years in prison, where for an individual who would steal the same amount would only be one. And I don't know if they have those laws in California or not.
Well, I don't know. Do they have them in New Mexico? That's the thing.
I don't know about New Mexico, but I know they had them in Michigan when I was in Detroit, for sure.
All right, fine. Well, I think so. Of course, certainly in Chicago, corruption was a way of life, in the police force. They were always trying to get the thing cleaned up, and, I don't know whether they've ever gotten it cleaned up. Well, anyway, of course, our guest this evening is Steve Doran, and we're simply talking about what happened in New Mexico there at Los Alamos. And, this is certainly almost a national disgrace now, and yet, of course, it's something, it has to be brought out, it has to be corrected, and it would be wonderful if they would simply do what was necessary and start firing people. And if people knew that their job was on the line, boy, I bet a lot of these people would get religion in a hurry.
I think so. And if you don't mind, Stan, if anybody has any problems in these areas or if there's anything I can help them with, I can be contacted my email is S, like my first name, Steve, L, like my middle name, which I won't tell you what it is, but L, like Larry. My last name, D as in David, O-R-A-N, S-L Doran, at survival.com. And if you want to see my ugly mug and what I look like, you can go to www.survival.com. Again, www.survival.com, and just click on Doran's Dugout. And I have a website there that I've established where new articles come out every week. At this particular point, it's for the troops that are going overseas, and it's amazingly based on arid land type survival, but that'll change as the year progresses.
Well, I hope that this war will be through very, very quickly, and that with as little loss of life as possible, we'll just have to wait and see.
Well, hopefully we can give them a few tips to help keep them alive a little longer. One of the things I know when I was in the military was that we did not get enough training, in the area of survival. And then when I got out, I found that, you know, the general population really was clueless on how to survive or how to even be prepared for, you know, significant situations like we've had in the recent past, like, you know, 9/11 and the potential problems we could have had, you know, during the Y2K situation. And, for about 18 years now, I've been teaching people how to be prepared and how to survive literally with little or nothing. And, to me, it's just been, you know, it's been a blessing just to, you know, to take somebody whose idea of roughing it was the Holiday Inn and be able to teach them, you know, outdoor survival skills so that no matter what situation they're in, they can always survive.
Well, I appreciate the fact that you're doing that, and I really feel that, you know, the American people are totally unprepared for any sort of a catastrophic event. After I talked to you on the earlier program, the next gentleman I interviewed was a man named Dor Gold, and he is the former American ambassador, pardon me, Israeli ambassador to the United Nations, but a very articulate spokesman, Jewish, of course. His family is over in Israel, and he'll be leaving in the next day or two to go back to Israel to be with them during the coming war. And his remark to me as I was talking about my concern over what was going to happen to Israel with this coming war was, well, he said, in Israel today, nobody makes fun of duct tape and plastic. And, of course, they are preparing rooms, for the protection of their families. They're seriously concerned about the possibility of chemical and biological warfare there.
Yeah.
How different it is in Israel, where they see violence and violence as a way of life, from here in America, where people can't imagine that anything like that could ever happen.
Yeah, my friend, I have a friend, Avi Lipkin. You may know him.
Oh, I know, sure.
And
Victor Mordecai.
Yeah, Victor Mordecai. And anyway, he has some real eye-opening information as it pertains to Israel, and people just really do not understand the pressure and the oppression that they live under on a daily basis and the things that they go through just to protect their children. And how, you know, I mean, I don't know about you, but if somebody came in and harmed my children in any way, there's no way that I could morally see myself holding back and not just literally annihilating him. And this happens to the Jewish people day in, day out.
Right. Well, would you be available this next hour? Maybe we could talk a little bit about your survival.
Sure.
If you don't mind, I really think it's a subject I'd like to bring up for our listeners. And so we'll talk about that because I think we pretty well exhausted
Los Alamos.
So let's do that. And so if you just sort of want to hang on, I've got to give a little information here to our listeners. So
yes.
This is the time when I have to remind our listeners in the Great Northwest, who will be losing very, very shortly, that Radio Liberty is listener-supported. And if you're out there and you're hearing us, and we hope that many of you will decide right now you're going to join the Radio Liberty family of supporters, because that's how we're able to stay on the air, not only in your area, but out across America. And what a unique opportunity it is, 5 hours every weekday. And then on our weekend program, where we have 35 stations that hear our program now, it's only a half-hour program, but it's amazing how much you can get out in a half hour with an organized effort. And so 35 stations do hear our program. And our hope is we can gradually keep expanding the number of stations where we're heard, certainly 2 hours a day on shortwave, 3 hours a day on satellite. Now, starting next week, 4 hours every weekday on satellite. And then, of course, we'll be doing our programs certainly on other stations on a regular basis, and the evening station up there in the Great Northwest, and the Sunshine Network, and the American Christian Network, and the American Freedom Network, and the Genesis Network, a unique opportunity of reaching out with information you're not going to get from the regular channels. So if you believe there's a problem, if you believe we're involved in a spiritual battle that's being fought on a political and ideological and cultural and financial and economic battlefield, why, feel free to give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. And then let me remind you about our website. It's simply RadioLiberty.com. That's RadioLiberty.com. And, of course, you can go there. You can pull down our active programs. You can listen to our programs live 3 hours a day, archive programs. We have a large number of them there, and we don't charge for them. Then, we, of course, we have my newsletters. We have some of the articles that I've written and other people have written. And we do hope that you'll go there, get that information, and encourage others to go to our website. And certainly we have a growing Internet listening audience. And it's amazing how many people will tell me they've just started listening. They're listening on a regular basis. And they're beginning to get educated and beginning to understand and grasp really the significance of so much what is happening. So that's www.radioliberty.com. And it's really by word of mouth that we're getting the information out. And so we hope that you'll tell others about our programs. You'll tell them about our website. And then, of course, you'll give serious consideration to becoming a member of the Radio Liberty family of supporters. And then, of course, this is the time when I want to remind you that America is moving into war. I anticipate a week from today that our boys will be advancing. The 17th of March is the day that has been given for if Saddam is not disarmed, why we will attack him. And, of course, the problem is that within about 2 or 3 weeks, it gets so hot over there, it's almost impossible to live. And you certainly can't wear these terrible, terrible uniforms, uniforms that protect you against chemical and biological warfare with this intense heat. In fact, they were demonstrating them at one of the conferences recently to show how effective they were. And they had a woman wearing one of them, and she fainted on the stage. So it gives you an idea, really, that even under the best situations, in a nice air-conditioned auditorium, people will pass out. Well, they've got to move, and they're going to move very quickly, so pray for our boys, and pray for the civilians over there. Certainly pray for the other people who are going to be involved. Pray for our leaders, for President Bush, for our ministers, because they should be leading this spiritual battle. And then, of course, pray for revival, because if America doesn't turn back to God, I believe God is going to turn his back on America. And lastly, we ask you to pray for my ministry, Radio Liberty, for our provision and protection. And so until tomorrow at the same time, Dr. Stan, good night, and may the Lord be with you. Well, good evening. This is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty. Coming in from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring, and I have to remind you that the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers, and of course we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. And with us this evening is Steve Doran, and he's not only a police officer, but he's a survival expert, and he, of course, very interested in teaching people how to survive. And, of course, I think these are things that people have to think about. Let's hope and pray that this war is a very, very easy one. But, you know, whenever you start a war, you don't know how it's going to end up. And certainly I remember when I don't remember, but I've read about, you know, when the English attacked the Boers in 1899, the Boer War, and everybody in England said, oh, this is going to be a tea time war. Our boys will be home by Christmas. Well, of course, three bloody years later, 100,000 British casualties later, the war ended. Only because it killed so many women and children there, that of the Boer women and children in the concentration camps, that the British public was outraged and the war was forced to come to an end. But we're going to war, and no longer do we have oceans that protect us. We have within this country many people who embrace the radical form of Islam. They've been recruited in our prisons, but with Saudi clerics who've gone into our prisons and, of course, indoctrinated many people there with this radical and infamous Islamic faith. And certainly many of our Muslims are not radical Islamic at all. But there is a component here that, of course, go to the radical mosque financed by the Saudi Arabians. And of course, we have the potential for the same sort of problems in America today that exist in Israel today with suicide bombings. People say it'll never happen here. And I would simply ask you, are you absolutely certain? So with that as a background, I'd like to certainly ask Steve to talk to us a little bit about the bare elements of survival, what people have to think about. There's certain things that everybody has to think about, and most people never bother to think about them. We just say, well, water comes out of a faucet, food comes out of a grocery store, and we just don't have to worry. And so how would you like to approach this, Steve?
Well, basically, when I was growing up, I really loved, when I say I led a sheltered life, I had grandparents who were just wonderful people who, came from the South, who came out of the Depression. And, one of the things that I never realized is that typically the average American citizen doesn't have any food in the house. I mean, we had more food than we could eat in a year. And so when snowstorms, I'm from Michigan, when those horrific snowstorms would hit, or, there would be power outages for weeks at a time. We always lived pretty well, and we always ate well. That's half of my problem. I ate too well. And so I never really saw a situation in my personal life as a child where... Oh, we got to go to a break?
No, we don't. I just turn off the music. Go ahead.
Okay. But anyway, we never, got into a situation where when there was a snowstorm that we were waiting at the grocery store, for 3 or 4 hours fighting over a can of tomatoes with, 200 other people. And it wasn't until I went into the Marine Corps that I started to see things like this happening when I was in North Carolina and, hurricanes and the like would hit and we would go assist the local law enforcement and people would be starving. And then when I got out of the Marine Corps and I went to work as a law enforcement officer and tornadoes would hit or we'd have some severe snowstorm and people were literally fighting, over a can of tomatoes at the grocery store because that's all that was left, or they would panic and they would begin to hoard, food products and whatnot in an effort, to stock up for the moment. And so I began to think of how crucial it was and how critical it was to teach people, to go back to the basics and have at least, 2 or 3 weeks worth of food, some type of, water storage unit so that they would have, plenty of water to drink for at least a week to 2 weeks. And then I got a little more involved where I began to train airline pilots and others, law enforcement officers, military personnel how to survive out in literally the middle of nowhere with little or nothing, you know, using pretty much what they had on their person. And so I think it's very critical, especially in today's day and age, that we all keep, in my opinion, you know, I typically keep a 3-month supply of everything at my residence. When I travel in my vehicle, I have, you know, depending on where I'm going and what I'm doing, I have 1 to 2 weeks worth of food, you know, food stuff and water. You know, it's a personal choice, but I personally believe that, you know, that you should have, you know, some type of firearm in your home for protection. You have to remember that police officers respond to crimes that have already been committed. We do not stop crime. We respond to crimes that have already been committed. So basically, it is your responsibility to protect yourself, your family, and your loved ones. How you choose to do that is your option.
Well, I'm so glad to hear a police officer say that, because we see so many of the political appointees, you know, within the law enforcement, you know, saying, oh, no, we can't have the public armed. And, of course, you know, I remember when they got a new chief of police in Washington, D.C., the murder capital of the world, and first thing he wanted to do was legalize the right to people to keep a weapon in their home, because he said just what you say, we don't have enough police to do this. If people have weapons, we're going to have less crime. He lasted about a week, and, of course, that was the end of him. But at least he said what needed to be said, and I know there are a lot of law enforcement people out there feel just as you do. They just don't get much of a play in the controlled media.
Right, and again, I mean, it's, you know, it's a personal choice, and one of the things that I continually harp on, I guess my only bone of contention is that, you know, if you're going to own a weapon for self-defense and personal protection, then, you know, you need to know how to use it, and you need to, you know, take some sort of training so that you're competent and so that you're safe and that you don't harm the wrong person.
Amen to that. And now, of course, let's talk about some of the things you're saying. You ought to have a couple of weeks' food on hand. And now water, of course, water storage. You have to have water on hand, you know, because you just never know what's going to happen. And that's one thing really we're really desperate for, as long as the water supply is fine. But what would happen if somebody poisoned the water supply? This actually could happen in our major cities. Then what would happen? Or be, you know, destroyed the major water mains. What would people do? They would be totally frantic because we're so dependent upon our society. People don't know how to survive without it.
Right. You know, water is the most critical supply that we need to have on hand. You can only live 3 days without it. And then, you know, your body begins to shut down and you will literally die, as opposed to being able to live 3 weeks without food. So, you know, it's definitely a situation where we, you know, you need to keep it on hand. My favorite way to store it is in the Mylar, the 5-gallon Mylar bag. That you put inside of the box. Are you familiar with that?
No, tell us about it.
Well, it's a system. They're 5-gallon Mylar bags. The water basically can be stored in them indefinitely. The bag fits inside of a box, an actual cardboard box, to make it easy to move so that pretty much anybody can pick it up and move it. But the nice thing about it is that you can put these 5-gallon bags of water in the closet inside of this box, and then put your shoes or whatever on top of it, and they don't take up much room, and really, until you need them, you don't even realize that they're there.
And then, of course, how do you seal the Mylar bags?
Well, the Mylar bag is actually, it's got like a rubber dispenser cap on it that you pull the, I don't know how to explain it, but there's a little nipple on there that you pull back and it releases the water.
Okay, fine.
So it's its own storage unit. It's basically... you know, or you could probably screw a cap on the end as well.
All right. And then it's got some sort of a round opening at the top?
Yes, so it's got a round opening to fill it, and then you put the cap on, and you can literally, as I said, just you can set, when you need the water, you can set the box on the counter at that point and just dispense it, you know, like you would any other beverage. You just pull this little you know, this little knob back, and it allows the water to flow freely out of the bag.
All right, fine. And so that sounds like a very efficient means of... people really need to have water on hand. And
Well, the nice thing about the five-gallon situation is that if you have to leave your residence for whatever reason and flee the area, if you have your water stored in 50-gallon drums or 100-gallon drums or whatever, it's almost impossible to move that or put it in the back of your car. Whereas with these 5-gallon bags, if you remove them from the cardboard box, you could literally take, you know, 30 or 40 gallons of water with you in just about any automobile and transport it to the next location that you know that you're going to.
Well, of course, that, food, certainly a light, things like that. Of course, most people have flashlights, but the flashlight batteries don't last forever.
Right.
And so I suppose people ought to have kerosene or certainly a Coleman lantern, something of that sort. Means of preparing food if you don't have gas and electricity. How do you prepare your food if you don't have that?
Right, well, you know, there's a couple of really neat things on the market now. The first thing, as far as light sources are concerned, they have the LED lights that literally last, you know, 100,000 hours on one battery. So as far as light sources are concerned, you have almost an unlimited amount of light available to you with these LED light systems.
Now, where would you get an LED light system?
You can actually, I bought my last one at Walmart. Walmart is starting to carry them. You can get them from the Sea Crane Company. You can get, if you go to the website, www.survival.com, the guy who runs that site, and Doran's Dugout, which is my site, which is attached to that site, has a light, and I'm trying to think of the name of it, but it's an LED light. They're really reasonable. They're like, they're under $20, and they last literally forever.
Is it just a flashlight battery, or what sort of a source?
Yeah, it just takes either a 9-volt battery or a AA battery, and they'll literally last 100,000 hours.
Really?
And you can keep them on for literally a year. You can turn it on, and the light will last a year. They're incredible products.
Now, of course, is this a light that you can read by, or is this just a light at least so that you can get around the house?
Oh, no, you can read by it.
Really?
Oh, yeah, it's they've come a long way. Originally, it was a light that you could just get around the house, but now they've gotten to the point where you can read and actually see. I mean, obviously, it's not a 300-watt bulb, but, I mean, it's good enough to perform whatever task you need to perform. They're wonderful.
All right, fine. So that's www.survival.com, and then, of course, they have these light sources available there. And you call them LED lights?
LED lights, and they have them at Sea Crane Company offers them as well. I know Walmart. I bought one at Walmart, so I know Walmart has them. You just have to kind of look real close to see what they have available. And I would assume, I haven't seen them there, but Radio Shack and those type of companies usually carry those types of items as well.
All right, fine. So that gives you at least some light. What about preparation of food, and even preservation of food? You know, we're really more or less dependent upon our refrigerators. We're dependent upon certainly for keeping the food. When the refrigerator goes off, why, the ice cream melts and everything melts, and then you just got a terrible mess. And so even keeping food is a real problem if you don't have ready access to electricity.
Right. Well, in my particular situation, you know, being a Polish hillbilly, I grew up eating a lot of dried, bean-type products, split peas, black-eyed peas, you know, beans. I keep a tremendous amount of that around. I like pasta. I purchase, the sun-dried tomatoes, which you can make, purchase in rather large quantities at places like GFS Warehouse. I purchase a lot of, like, different bouillon-type products to flavor, different things that I'm making. And, a person can live and eat pretty well relatively cheaply, you know, eating pastas and whole grains and things, and they literally, again, it's products that'll last forever. They're easy to store. They don't take a lot of space. There's really no need to go out and buy. I'm not knocking it because, I mean, a lot of the long-term storage foods are excellent. They taste excellent, but you can pretty much do your own long-term storage type foods you know, just by going to the grocery store and, you know, purchasing the freeze-dried or packaged foods that's right on the shelf, you can get it a lot cheaper. You know, you can buy just regular plastic buckets to, you know, displace the food in so that it's not exposed to air or light. And what I like to do in my particular situation, because I find it more effective for me, is I rotate through the food. I use it and then replace it, so I always have a fresh supply. And then if something happens, my food is no more than a year old. And you can buy, you know, again, instant mashed potatoes. And again, you know, the key here is, as we discussed, is water. In order to cook these things, you have to have water to cook it. And again, if you feel that you're in an area where you won't be evacuated or there's no need to evacuate, you know, again, you know, you can buy, you know, canned soups and meats and stuff like that. Again, but the only problem with that is if you have to move, it's heavy, it's hard to move, it's hard to transport, where the dry goods are very lightweight. You can in a couple of 5-gallon buckets, you can literally have almost a year's supply of food if you ration it appropriately. And they also have, at health food stores now, they have a stuff called TVP, which is textured vegetable protein, and it's a dried product. And when you add water to it, you can make it taste. They can make it taste like anything from sausage to hamburger. And again, it's very readily available. I think it's made from soybeans, but it's an excellent product. It tastes good. And the only other thing that I would recommend is that, you know, not that I'm not fat enough, but in high stress situations, we tend to burn a lot of calories. So what I like to keep is on hand, which lasts, again, you can keep it for years, is lard. And the reason I keep that is because we do need an additional, when we're under stress like that, we need additional amounts of fat in our system, you know, to sustain a healthy lifestyle and, you know, and not get our systems bound up and that type of thing. So I do keep typically 2 or 3 5-pound buckets of lard, which, again, keep forever as an additional food source, you know, should I need it.
Well, now, does that have to be refrigerated? Or?
No, sir. That's the beauty of it, is that it does not need refrigeration, and it literally has an unlimited shelf life, and it doesn't go rancid.
Okay, so lard is something you don't even really think about anymore.
Right. Well, lard, again, it's a natural food product where, like, you know, Crisco and your vegetable oils and whatever really don't provide that same nutritional value. And again, you're talking about you're eating smaller amounts of food because you're spreading it out over a longer period of time, and so you need to pack the most punch that you can in the meals that you're getting. And you know, again, if you go to www.survival.com, there are lists there, free lists that you just click on and you can obtain of, you know, things that you need to buy and things that you need to keep on hand and how to make long-term, short-term survival kits, you know, things of that nature, you know, that again, they're very nutritional, but because you're eating smaller amounts over a long period of time, you want to get the best bang for your buck. And, you know, one of the things I make is sort of a 20th century pemmican, which contains, you know, beef tallow, instant mashed potatoes, and then dried beef. And, you know, just like the old brokering commercials, a little dab will do you. A little dab goes a long way. And it's one of the things we take when we go out on survival trips, where people get, you know, the energy they need without taking, you know, a lot of heavy weighted foods with them. So, you know, there's all kinds of tricks of the trade and things that you can do. You know, I would encourage people, you know, to talk to their, you know, to talk to their elders, to talk to their grandparents, to talk to, you know, older aunts and uncles, and you would be amazed at what they know and how, you know, how skilled they are at preparing, you know, dry foods and making them taste good, and how skilled they are at storing foods for long periods of time. It's something that they've done all their life, and they're very good at it, and they can give you a tremendous amount of help.
Well, you know, it's very interesting that the average individual today, I think, finds it very difficult to believe that anything could happen to almost the utopian life we lead. And yet, if the FEMA apparently is making plans, with relocation camps, they are seriously considering there's going to be disruptions of our society. Have you heard anything about that?
Well, I mean, it's no secret. I mean, it's been going on. You know, the United States has been preparing for that for long periods of time. It's nothing new. They have, different centers set up across the United States to care for, tremendous amounts of people. And like I said, I mean, all you have to do, again, I'm not real familiar with California. I haven't spent a lot of time there. But when you live in the Midwest and the East, all you have to do is wait for the first big snowstorm to come along, and you will see how unprepared people in general are and how they are literally lining up at the grocery stores, purchasing everything in sight, fighting over food in the aisles. And, you take that same scenario in a little, nothing snowstorm, and you have a chemical agent released over an area. You have a serious, detonation situation like we had at 9/11 in New York, and how easy it would be, and how necessary it may be to move those people to a different location, because in a relatively short period of time, they would be cutting each other's throats, for a can of soup, and that's the society we live in. We live in a society where people want instant gratification. They're used to going to 7-Eleven at 2 o'clock in the morning and getting their Snickers bar and having it readily available, or going to 24-hour McDonald's. And when those types of operations shut down and those people aren't prepared, let me tell you something, they're willing to go to do whatever they've got to do to feed themselves.
Well, of course, the thing that really bothers me is the fact that, if there was a major event, it really almost anywhere in the country, it could begin to shut down the delivery system that we have. In other words, if there was a chemical attack in the Midwest, trucks are not going to run through the Midwest from east to west across the country. A major attack, certainly anywhere that would disrupt the highway, would mean we wouldn't be getting the trucks in delivering the products, which we anticipate. The grocery stores don't have a lot of food. It's all brought in on a regular basis, on a
That's
daily
correct.
Basis, and people don't understand that. The same thing with the drugstores, and the hospitals are don't have a lot of medicines there. They're constantly getting this in from elsewhere. And, of course, what's so vitally important is the fact that people do have their supplies and they lay them in ahead of time. We're talking about a total possibility of a total disruption here. Now, hope and pray it doesn't happen, but stop and think about it. We have, America is attacking another nation. Now, we justify going to war with a nation, well, they might attack us sometime in the future. But you look around the world, and we don't have a lot of allies, not among the people. We've got a lot of allies among the governments that we've bribed to. We give $1 billion to Jordan and a couple of billion dollars to Kuwait and a couple of billion dollars to Qatar. But we're buying the governments. We're not buying the people. I mean, the people in Turkey were so inflamed at the idea of moving American troops through Turkey that the parliament refused to go along with the government, and they were afraid of a revolt there. And this is exactly what they're afraid of in Pakistan, that there will be a revolution there against the government, and the radical Islamists will take over. In fact, it seems that the number of people turning to this radical form of Islam is actually being increased because of what we're doing. And in fact, it was Congressman Ron Paul who said that, talking about the coming war, he feels that we've fallen into Osama bin Laden's trap. We're going to do more than any other thing possible to recruit people to Osama bin Laden's, cause. And these people may not join al-Qaeda, but of course, with their heart, will be with it. And the tragedy is, instead of trying to win friends and bring them to our point of view, there's a recent article in the Washington Post. And, of course, people ask, who is the most dangerous man in the world? It's not Osama bin Laden. It's George Bush. 80% of the people throughout the world who were interviewed said George Bush. Now, that is a terrible, terrible reflection on America and everything we stand for. And, of course, what will this eventually result in here in the United States? Well, if you're out there in the listening audience, give us a call at 464-8295 or 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Our guest is Steve Doran. We're talking about survival preparation. Now, how would people, think about preparing food if you didn't have electricity, you didn't have, natural gas, these things that we're so dependent upon, for heating our food? Or would we, just go out in the backyard, make a little fire there? Or would we use our grill that we have for grilling steaks, putting twigs in there to get a fire to heat things? How would people do this? People are just not used to this.
Well, personally, I like the Dutch oven concept, which is, using cast iron because of its heat retention qualities and that type of thing. And I also like, you can store very safely, you can store large quantities of charcoal briquettes in an airtight container. And you can store, literally the huge, I don't know how many gallon they are, 30-gallon plastic garbage cans full of them, and you don't have to worry about, the explosions or, fires or creating hazards within your home. I mean, they're perfectly safe. It's just charcoal. And I like to use that system because they're excellent for cooking. It only takes 28 briquettes to make a huge, pot of beans or meat or whatever you happen to be cooking. And they typically last forever, and if they don't burn completely, they can be reused until they're completely gone. So that's what I like to use, only because it's probably the safest method. As far as every home I've ever owned, I've had a wood stove in it. And then if you live in the city, kerosene is an option, but again, storing large quantities of kerosene is extremely dangerous. So I would probably, recommend, talking to someone in your area that really knows about, heating and cooling systems and find out what the most efficient and safe, heating system you can get for your home. And there again, as long as you have shelter from the wind and the rain and the elements, if you have, high-quality sleeping bags and feather comforters and that type of thing, you can really bear some extreme weather conditions as long as you're not out in the elements. So, it's a lot more comfortable to have a heating system, but it's really not necessary.
Well, of course, my concern is that most people, I'm 74, I'm not going to be able to go rushing off into the woods like you, all the young people like you. But we've got an awful lot of people out there who have just never even contemplated that something could come along that would disrupt our ideal society. And I hope and pray that it doesn't happen. But I think it would be foolish if we didn't, of course, encourage people to begin making the plans and having the things on hand just in case the unthinkable should become reality. If you're out there in the listening audience and you'd like to give us a call, if you have any question or comment, don't be bashful. Our telephone number, 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. We certainly have something called Making the Best of Basics, an excellent book by James Talmadge Stevens, talking about a lot of the things we're talking about now, a lot of wonderful recipes and means of preparation and saving. But I think it's just a matter of going over these issues, and I'd never heard of LED light, LED lights. Probably lots of things out there we need to learn more about. We'll be back in just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan, our guest this evening is Steve Doran. We're talking about survival, and he, of course, has studied survival and teaches survival techniques to people. And, of course, survival depends upon what part of the country you're in, but course, my major concern is I hear in the civilized California, we're not out in the middle of the desert. We're not up in the snow country of the high Sierras. We're here, of course, in an urban setting. And, of course, if there were problems, it's sort of what happens in New York when the lights go out in the middle of the night. And suddenly it's a jungle there. I mean, there's looting. This has happened not once, but many, many times. And unfortunately, in our cities, at least in the inner cities, there seems to be enough people there. It may not be a majority, but enough people to completely disrupt society. Well, this probably would not happen in a community such as ours. At least we hope not. But what would happen if there were real shortages of food? What would happen if there were real shortages of the basic necessities we need? And of course, people, have gotten so used to almost have a feeling that they're entitled to anything they want, that if people do not make preparations now, really, I'm concerned of the consequences of what may happen down the line. So if you have a question, a comment, telephone number, 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. Well, we've talked about the food, basic food substances. We've talked about the importance of having water. What are some of the other things that people should have on hand and should keep readily available? What about the possibility of a chemical or biological attacks? How would they be approached? As I mentioned earlier when I was talking to Ambassador Dor Gold, he said, in Israel today, nobody's laughing about duct tape and plastic.
Right. You need to have, in the case of, biological or chemical weapons, I hate to say this, but in all reality, typically by the time you find out that you've been hit by a chemical agent, it's too late. So, trying to obtain gas masks and carry them around and get them on in time, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, is almost a waste of time. But the safe rooms are definitely a situation that you need to take a look at. They're very easy to make as far as, putting plastic over the windows, duct taping the seams, so that none of these agents can get into that room. It's very easily done, and typically people who are at home and they receive the warning on television or radio that a chemical agent, has been released, do have time to go to that room and complete the sealing of that room. So that is something that you need to take a serious look at. You can take a room of the home and do that that's not used on a regular basis so that it doesn't disrupt your lifestyle too much. And again, I would encourage people, to get back to the basics. Have a, have a day where you prepare meals, using dry goods, where you... where you don't use the water from the tap, where you don't use your heating and air conditioning, and learn to survive without it. I mean, the time to learn this stuff is now while there's not a problem. You don't want to wait till a couple weeks before the problem. You don't know how to make bean soup out of dried pinto beans. You don't have any water stored or you have it stored improperly and it turns rancid. The time to learn this, these skills is today. And there's just a tremendous amount of information out there, that's provided both by the federal government, people like Ron Hood at that website, www.survival.com, and a lot of this information is free of charge. There are videotapes you can buy that'll teach you these skills. And again, it's something that we all need to know. We need to get away from this lifestyle where, we're looking for immediate gratification. We need to learn how to cook again. We need to learn that the only place to get food is not McDonald's or pre-prepared things at the grocery store. And again, I mean, it's, in my opinion, it's a lot of fun. I mean, one of the things that I love doing with my boys is, we make jerky and we make sausage and we go out on outings and we cook in the Dutch oven. And to us, I mean, we're having a good time, and they're learning, and I'm, even though I've been doing this for over 20 years now, I mean, there's always things to learn. There's always things that other people tell me or give me tips and ideas, and we just have a good time with it. I mean, we don't consider it a chore in the least. It's just something that we do as part of our life so that we're consistently prepared.
All right. Well, I certainly agree with that. What about medical supplies? What should people have on hand for the medical point of view?
Well, again, if you can do it, and I'm not by any means, you know, condoning anyone doing anything illegal, but, you know, one of the things you can do is ask your physician to write your, especially if you're on certain prescription medicines that you absolutely have to have, you can ask your physician to, you know, give you a few extra with each prescription so that you can have, you know, as an example, a 30-day supply on hand. Typically what I do is just keep the basic medications around. I keep, you know, like 100. I have a problem, you know, with getting sinus headaches, so I typically keep 100 additional, like Tylenol sinus around. I keep aspirin around, which is obviously we all know now that it's good for your heart. I keep an assortment of bandages, both the adhesive type and the gauze type that you wrap around your arm. Again, there are these first aid kits available now. They've just come out with them that you can purchase relatively. They're relatively inexpensive. And the way that they're set up is you literally, let's just say you burn yourself. You open the first aid kit. You go to the section that says burn. It not only has everything in there to treat your burn, but it has instructions on how to use everything that's contained within the package and how to continue to treat it on your own until you can receive medical treatment or if you can't receive medical treatment. Another book I'd like to recommend, and I keep a copy not only in my vehicle, I keep a copy at my home. It's called Ditch, D-I-T-C-H, Medicine. And you can get it through Amazon.com. It basically tells you how to treat any injury or illness with basically little or no medication or supplies at all. It's a wonderful book when I travel out of the country. It's always something that I, you know, keep in my suitcase or my backpack. I literally never leave home without it. I travel with that more than I do my American Express.
Okay.
The other thing that we need to do is also not only are we keeping, you know, not only do we need to keep these items in our home, we need to keep these items in our vehicle, okay? Because you got to remember, you may be in a situation where you're at work, you're away from home, you're traveling abroad, whatever the case may be, and an incident occurs and you can't get back to your residence. So you have to make sure that you have an ample amount of supplies in your vehicle to sustain you for an extended period of time. And one of the things I do and that you know is very, very, very important is I don't live off the ATM. I always keep in my, this is my personal opinion, I always keep at least $1,000 in cash with me at all times. And the reason I do that is because if there's an incident and power goes out and ATMs don't work and nobody's taking credit cards, I can, you know, hopefully buy fuel or whatever I need to get to wherever I need to go. And so I am not an ATM dependent individual and I'm not a credit card dependent individual. I carry cash, I use cash, I don't get in, obviously we need credit cards on, you know, to buy plane tickets or whatever it's for certain situations. But I am a cash man through and through, and I always keep a minimum of $1,000 on my person so that if anything were to go wrong, I have the ability to get where I need to be or get what I need to get.
All right. Well, that sounds like a very good idea, and that's DitchMedicine.com or Ditch Medicine, a book from Amazon sounds like something pretty well worthwhile getting.
Right, and it's just common sense. We have to get away. We have to get back to the basics. We have to quit relying on things that we've become accustomed to. You have to think about what would happen if all of that were to end tomorrow, and I'm not, you know, I'm by no means saying that, you know, we're going to be in an Armageddon-type situation. But what I am saying is what would you do? Walk over to your cupboard right now, and open it up, and do you literally have enough food and water to survive for a week or 2 weeks? Or do you just have enough to survive until tomorrow morning?
Well, now, do you suggest that when you store water that you put chlorine in it, little Clorox or something?
Actually, they with the Mylar bags, the beauty of the Mylar bag is once you fill it up, what I typically do is I take one or two drops of Clorox, just the plain old Clorox, and I put it in a bucket, and I cleanse around the nozzle portion where my hands have touched, and then secure the cap on top of that. And I typically don't put anything in the water because the Mylar bags keep the light out and the light and the oxygen, so really it doesn't give anything a chance to grow. And as I told you, I try to rotate not only my food supplies but my water supplies just so that I keep a fresh supply, so I'll empty it out and refill it probably at least each box once a year. And the way these boxes are designed, you know, I don't know how many closets you have in your house. In my house, where I currently live, I have 6 closets, which allow me to store, you know, close to 100 gallons of water and without even noticing it, because it's in the bottom of the closet. I set my shoes on top of the boxes or other items on top of the boxes, and it's not even noticeable. So even if you live in an apartment, you can store 100 gallons of water without even thinking about it.
Well, now these Mylar bags, I see them advertised all the time. Are all Mylar bags with a sort of a ring on the top? Or?
Yes, all the Mylar bags have this ring on the top, which allows you to, it's not only a cap, but it allows you to dispense the water. And like I said, the ones that I buy, or the ones that I prefer, I'm sorry, I don't have a brand name, but the ones that I prefer actually come in with a cardboard box, and they're very readily available. I've bought them from 2 or 3 different sources, and they're like, again, they're the 5-gallon size, because just about anyone can lift them and get them out and, you know, put them on the counter and use them. And again, if you have to leave, you can take them with you.
Now, whereabouts would you get the Mylar bags?
I'm trying to think of the last company. I've had mine for so long. I'm trying to think of the last company I bought them from. I'll tell you what, if you know, people want to go to the website, I'll make sure that Ron posts a location where they can be obtained. But right now, at the top of my head,
all right. All right, fine. And of course, that's survival.com.
Mm-hmm.
All right, fine. That's survival.com if you want to go there. And these are just all things to think about. But remember, we're talking about going to war in a week from today. If it goes as planned, why, I believe we'll be probably launching an attack, unless, of course, Saddam Hussein goes into exile. And I see very little possibility or very little suggestion he's going to do that at the present time, although I would certainly hope that he would, and that this would be solved without bloodshed. My fear is it's not going to be. So, I think most people really have never thought of the implications of what could happen. I mean, war is something that the American people have never seen, have never experienced. A few of the men have been in the military and have seen it, but the average individual has no concept. The people of the Middle East have, the people of Israel have, but here are people of Europe have, which is why, of course, they are so dead set against war. This is why they, after the First World War, they were willing to give up their national sovereignty to the League of Nations. Certainly after the Second World War, they were. But the American people have never experienced war. And this is one of the great tragedies, why I think so many people today think that this is going to be just something like we see on the screen, but it isn't going to affect them, it's going to affect somebody else. So, and I hope and pray that it doesn't affect the people here, but of course, if you look at it from a spiritual point of view, if God truly is just, his justice will not sleep forever. Well, if you're out there in the listening audience, you have a question or comment, our telephone number, 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. If you have anything you'd like to ask our special guest today, Steve, why this is the time to do it, because he's certainly far better at this than I am. He's been studying this and making preparations for many, many years. And, George, do you think the average American is really making any serious preparations for the possibility of serious problems?
Actually, I really don't believe so.
How about these water filtration bottles people talk about?
Well, again, it's a situation where it's a water filtration bottle lasts, a very short period of time. you know, you're better off with, especially if you're going to, you know, get, you know, use it in your home or, you know, you're going to carry it in your car, to use like the Brita water filter where you pour the water in the top and it drains down through.
Right.
Into the container, because you can filter a lot more water a lot more quickly than you can with those little water bottles. And basically what it is you fill it up and then you try to squirt it in your mouth, and it really takes a lot of energy and effort. And I would only recommend those if you were, you know, out in the woods or out in a very, you know, out in a very remote location. But as far as filtering your water in a city environment, just get a Brita with, you know, several filters and use that. Also, I would recommend, you know, since we're on that subject, you know, that if people are going to store things like, you know, coffee and tea, that they're better off storing things like tea, because tea quenches thirst where coffee induces it. So when you drink coffee, it actually makes you thirstier than if you hadn't drank it at all. So if you need your caffeine fix, get it with tea versus coffee.
What about salt, things like that? Is that an important thing to have?
Yeah, salt is very important because it allows you to preserve foodstuffs. It also, obviously, our bodies need it when we're, you know, if, as an example, if we don't have the luxuries that we're used to and we're working harder and having to do more manual labor, we need to replace the salt that we've lost in our system. And also, spices are always a good thing. One of the things I'm accused of when I take people out on survival trips is that I'm cheating and I'm sneaking food in. And one of the reasons they accuse me of that is if I'm making squirrel or marmot or whatever else I'm making, just like they are, is that I carry a tremendous amount of spices with me because they're lightweight, and you can and a little bit goes a long way. And so I always flavor my food with these different spices, and they think that I've smuggled something in. And the reality is I've just made it taste better than their squirrel on a stick or whatever they happen to be preparing that evening. And so spices are very important. They're cheap, they're inexpensive, they're lightweight. You can store a lot of them in a very small space, and they can make things that aren't very tasty taste very good.
All right. Well, that's certainly something I would not necessarily have thought of. All right. What are some of the other things that you would like to suggest that people ought to be thinking about at this time?
Well, again, warm clothing, good blankets. I prefer, you know, to have, obviously, next to your skin, you want something soft like cotton. But basically, you have to remember the rule that cotton kills. Once cotton gets cold, it stays cold, and you can't warm it up again. You use all of your body heat and your calories and energy warming up the thing that's supposed to be keeping you warm. So what I like to do is have wool blankets on hand. Again, they're easy to store. They're warm. When they get wet, they stay warm. And you can have like a cotton blanket to separate you from the wool if it bothers you. It doesn't bother me. Being an ex-Marine, I have wool wrapped around me a lot. But if it does bother you, you can put something between you and the wool blanket. It'll keep you warm. Have proper clothing, proper shoes that fit. And I'm saying this to the women in the audience because they are the biggest offenders. Typically, they buy shoes that look good versus shoes that fit their feet properly, that allow them to walk long distances. So make sure you have proper footwear so that if you have to walk, you know, a good distance, you don't arrive with bloody feet. Again, good socks, the Cool Max socks. Again, if you can, avoid cotton at all costs. They have the new material. It's a nylon material. It's soft like cotton, but they make clothing in it now. And it's really good stuff. You can get it at places like REI or camping stores. It's a combat cloth nylon. And it comes, you can buy the same fashions that you're buying in cotton, but it keeps you warm. If it gets wet, it dries out relatively quickly. It's an excellent, excellent product. Your socks, you don't want cotton socks. You want the Cool Max or the wool blend socks, and I know people say, well, it makes my feet itch. However, it's the only material that provides good protection to your feet. You know, when you're required to walk long distances, it also keeps your feet warm, where cotton doesn't do any of those things.
All right, fine. So then preparing, you know, your clothing, this is something it's important to think about. And I'd hope and pray that you'd never used any of these things. But, you know, if the time should come, it's far better to be prepared and not need it than not to be prepared. And, of course, need it at that point, why you're not going to be able to get your hands on much of anything. So is there any other really important issues that we haven't covered tonight as far as the basics of survival is concerned?
Well, the basics, like we said, you know, one of the things you have to keep in mind is you can live, you know, 3 minutes without air. Remember the rules of three. 3 minutes without air, 3 hours without shelter, 3 days without water, 3 weeks without food. And that's how you, you know, make your priority list of what you need to have and how much of it that you need to have. And you have to take your children in consideration. As a Christian, I believe that we need to show the love of Christ. So if you have an elderly person in the neighborhood that's not capable of caring for themselves, you have to prepare to care for them as well. Or a mother, a single mother with young children, it is your responsibility, in my mind, under God's law, that we have to care for those people as well. And we have to, you know, make preparation for them and help them as best we can. Another rule, like I said, remember, cotton kills unless you live in a tropical environment. You need to get, you know, good, substantial clothing that will keep you warm, that will keep you dry in any situation. Remember to keep a certain amount of, you know, don't rely on your credit cards and ATMs. Keep as much cash as you can on hand because it may be the only thing that you're able to use. Keep a kit not only in your home but in your vehicle in case you're separated from your home. And, you know, and the roads are blocked. Just, again, in California, I mean, a perfect example was when you had the earthquake and cars weren't moving and people weren't able to get home. And they sat for days and days and days on the expressway and the roadways, you know, unable to move. And the National Guard had to come in and try to distribute food to these people in their vehicles. And a lot of them were starving by the time, you know, they were approached. Another thing, a very important thing that I've forgotten to mention is, you know, waste disposal. You need to have plenty of plastic bags to dispose of your human waste. It's one of the things that will make you sick quicker than anything if you can't properly dispose of it. If you don't have water and toilets aren't flushing, you have to have a way to store it, to keep it away from your family and your food and that type of thing. So the best way to do that is to be able to seal it in plastic heavy-duty trash bags, so you need to keep those on hand as a way to, you know, take your human waste and remove it from your living area without contaminating your food and water and the area that you're living in.
All right. Well, we've certainly covered an awful lot of things, and I appreciate so much your staying with us this extra hour and providing us some wisdom and some thought. It was certainly sort of a spontaneous thing on my part, but I'm so glad that you have this expertise and knowledge. And again, that website is www.survival.com, right?
That's correct. And then my name, my initials anyway, S.L. Doran, D-O-R-A-N. At survival.com, and if anybody has any questions, feel free to contact me direct. And if there's anything I can help you with or any information I can provide you with, I'd be more than happy to do so.
Well, God bless. Thanks so very much. I really appreciate you being with us.
All right. Thank you, sir. Right. And any time.
Bye-bye. Good night. Bye. Okay, fine. Well, that was Steve Doar, and I hope you enjoyed our program, sort of a spontaneous program. But, you know, I think that all of these things are things to think about. And I know that some of you out there are thinking about it. Others think that it's so absurd that, that somehow you don't have an obligation to prepare for yourself and your family. And I think we all do. And I think not only for ourselves, but for our neighbors as well. And if we don't make preparations, who will? And if not now, when? So remember, we're simply a week before America goes to war. And so if you have any other questions, just get hold of me, get hold of Steve. Certainly we do have some items as far as ready reserve food catalogs or various types of water filtration systems if you're interested in them. And you can give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-5-HIV-WAR if you'd like any more information or references on that. And then, of course, this is the time when we once again have to mention that Radio Liberty is listener-supported. We're dependent on those of you out across America who listen to our programs, who are really concerned about what's happening to our society. And if you believe that we are a voice of reason in a world gone mad, if you believe that we're not getting the truth many times from the controlled media, well, I hope that many of you will decide you're going to join the Radio Liberty family of supporters. And it's those faithful people out there across America who month in, month out, year in, year out, of course, remember us on a monthly basis, who've kept us going. And we have some people who've been with us, you know, 6-7 years now. I think we started in 1994, and they've been with us ever since. And so I guess that's even more than 6 years, isn't it? Well, anyway, we appreciate their help, their support. And if you'd like to become part of the Radio Liberty family of supporters, it's as simple as picking up your telephone and calling 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. And remember, we do have a voice. When you join the Radio Liberty family, you become part of that voice. That's what keeps us going. And then, of course, our website, www.radioliberty.com. That's radioliberty.com. And if you go there, you'll find our newsletters and things that I've written and some things that other people have written. You'll find our certainly our live programs. You'll find our archive programs, our links to other networks where you can hear Radio Liberty on a regular basis. And then, of course, it's really up to you to tell other people about our programs, to tell them about our website, because if we can get them started listening on a regular basis, why, hopefully their perspective will change. And it's amazing how many times I'll get calls from people who will tell me how just simply listening to our programs has changed their whole outlook on what's going on in America. So if you'd like to, of course, help other people, I think the greatest gift you can give to anyone is to bring them into an understanding of what's going on, and hopefully, once they begin understanding the nature of the spiritual battle in which we're engaged, once they understand the true nature of the evil that is aligned against our society, hopefully it will tend to lead them towards the Lord. Because in the final analysis, what can we accomplish here in this world other than perhaps to bring people into that personal relationship that will provide for them not only while they're here, but throughout all eternity? And I look forward, perhaps, when we get to heaven, to meeting some of the people who've been out there listening to our programs through the years, and perhaps it's had an impact. I know I've talked to some people who've told me really how this has changed their entire perspective. Well, that's all we can hope for. And, of course, when you become part of our family of supporters, you become part of that effort. So everybody doesn't have an opportunity to have a radio station in their home. But then, of course, how many people have had a radio station built for them by somebody else, which is exactly what happened to us. But I always feel that God had a plan in what's happened, and I believe we're doing exactly what we're supposed to be doing. And, well, anyway, what a privilege it is to be able to speak out on a regular basis. Pray for America. Pray for the boys going into battle and for the civilians, both Arab and Israeli over there. Pray for our leaders and our president. Pray for our ministers. And please remember to pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and protection. And so until tomorrow at the same time, Dr. Stan, good night, and may the Lord be with you.
All these copies of the New Age writing people, you're silent. Well, we have friends in military and government, and they say, now, Jeannie, they know you're up there living up here. They're taking, you know, they're keeping track of us. Oh, it's not so many Americans in the month of mine.
Well, this fellow says that he is an American too. He picked up and he moved down there, and he listened to you.